Welcome to the Knife Junkie Podcast, your weekly dose of knife news and information about knives and knife collecting. Here's your host, Bob the Knife Junkie DeMarco.
Welcome to the Knife Junkie Podcast. I'm your host, Bob DeMarco. On this edition of the show, I'm speaking with Brian Moreland of JB Knife and Tool. Along with friend John Stubbs, Brian makes some of the most coveted custom Pakal-style fixed-blade EDC knives out there. And they got my attention shortly after my interview with Ed Calderon, when my fascination for Pakal-style knives first blossomed. A year later, I bought one of their flagship knives, the Ditch Pick, in double-edged. And it carries so easily and has so much defensive capability in it that I'm already looking forward to my next acquisition, just to round out the collection, if you will. But the work of JB Knife and Tool isn't just optimized for defensive tactics. They also have a lot of practical tools also. And they're easy on the eyes. And you know, I put a lot of stock in that. So let's get right to it. But first, please like, comment, subscribe, and hit the notification bell. And if you can't finish this episode in video form, remember to download it to your favorite podcast app. That way you can listen on your way to work tomorrow or when you mow the lawn on Saturday. And if you think what we do here is valuable and you want to help support the show while enjoying interview extras, knife giveaways, stickers, early access to the show, and more, you can do so on Patreon. The quickest way to get there is to head over to thenifejunkie.com/Patreon. That's thenifejunkie.com/Patreon.
Do you like the sound of the alphanumeric combinations M390, 204P, and 20CV, but bristle at 8CR13MOV and AUS-A? You are a knife junkie. Probably worse.
Brian, welcome to the show.
Hey, thanks for having me, man.
Hey, it's good to have you. As I mentioned right up front, the stuff that really got my attention from JB Knife and Tool are knives like this one that I bought, the Ditch Pick, but these Pakal-style tip-down, edge-in knives,
right, which
you guys accelerated making. Where did this... Yeah, absolutely. I mean, like, all of your models, my favorite are those, and you have a lot in that category. how did this come about, this fascination in particular?
When we started making knives, we were heavy into like the bushcraft, outdoorsy type knives, because we both like to camp and hunt and fish. But I also train in Filipino martial arts, and I really just wanted to start building knives that I was going to carry every day as like a defensive tool. My wife had started training with me. She wanted a knife to carry as well. So John and I just kind of switched gears and went on to start making knives that we wanted to carry as a tool every day, or for defensive purposes every day. And that's kind of how it started. The first real Pakal style blade that we created was the Sackett. And that one was actually made for my wife. Because I wanted her to start doing a lot of Pakal style work, and she was worried somebody was going to take the blade away from her because she was tiny and had little hands. And so I started working reverse edge stuff and made the Sackett and put the finger notch in it for to kind of help keep it retained. And there was a whole process to how we came up with this design, and then this kind of started everything for it.
So you train in Filipino martial arts. What are you training in exactly?
I trained with a man named Mike Blackgrave here in San Antonio. Some people will know him. Some people like him. Some people absolutely hate him. He just has that kind of personality. But it was a illustrissimo based Filipino style. So that's for the past whatever 10, 12 years. That's what I've done there. With regards to that, but I mean, I did Sayoc for a little while. I did Pakiti Tercia for a little while as well. But the illustrissimo side was what I stuck with.
So Pakiti Tercia, I've got some experience with Pakiti Tercia, and that seems especially optimized to this kind of tip down edge in knife. Even though I don't ever remember seeing a knife like this before recently. A lot of that sort of trapping with the in reverse grip always seemed to me like it needed an edge on the inside.
Yeah. So most Filipino based systems that I've seen have some kind of Pakal work in them. It's just not heavily done because there's so much emphasis put on that medium and long range, style. So that, you know, the reverse edge stuff doesn't really, you know, that's not conducive for medium or long range. It's really more of an up close personal type. I'm a big guy. I'm not super fast, so I like being close enough to grab a hold of you and close enough to, you know, to get in tight. So I like the smaller blades with a reverse grip, and that's kind of how we, that was always my thought process on that.
So the very first Pakal style knife you guys started to do was the one you have in your hand, and this was designed for your wife. What was it like? Tell me a little bit about the experience and the considerations going into designing that knife. I mean, you designed it for your wife, and the presumption is, oh, well, this is for a woman, and she's smaller and weak, but it's something that everyone could use. Tell me what went into making that.
So the reason I wanted to do like a reverse edge blade with her is specifically she had a fear of somebody coming up and grabbing her wrist and her not being able to use the blade. So with the edge on the inside, we worked a lot of just her dropping weight and stepping back and just trying to fillet everything that was in the way of that edge and then coming back in, you know, with an attack. She also had or has very small hands. So there's kind of this neck point here. If you grab a piece of clay and squeeze it, you end up with a shape that looks about like that. And that was how I wanted the handle to fit. I wanted it to be comfortable in her hand. And not move and not slip and not, you know, not get away from her. So we did this kind of exactly that, took a piece of clay, gripped a hold of it, and then ended up with this shape handle and smoothed the edges out. I put the notch up here initially just so I knew that, the edge wasn't on this side. The edge is opposite of where my finger is, you know, and tried to make it as super simple for her as possible. And that's what went into the design for that. And a funny story about this blade is when I designed this and made this and we posted it, I didn't know who Craig Douglas was. Like, I didn't know who he was, and then so one day I get a phone call from Craig about, hey man, I want to talk to you about your second. It looks a lot like the clinch pick. I didn't know what a clinch pick was at the time. So him and I talked and worked everything out, and everything was great. And he's a good guy. But
this is South Nark, Southern Nark,
South Nark, yeah,
South Nark,
yeah.
Oh, interesting, because it bears a glancing resemblance, but most knives bear a glancing resemblance of all others.
At the time, it had a like the original one, which I probably should have dug out. I have it in a box here. It's got a fatter handle to it, and the blade steel was 1/8-inch stock instead of the 1/16-inch stock that we're doing the Ditch series out of. And really, all he was concerned about is he didn't want us to have an egg-shaped handle, and I didn't want an egg-shaped handle either. I wanted flat sides, so it didn't rotate in my hand, and it laid flat against me when I carried it. So we were square after that. I was like, yeah, no, I don't. That's cool. We're good on the egg-shaped handle deal.
He doesn't seem like the kind of guy you want to cross.
No. And he's a gentleman. I mean, he's a really nice fella. So.
For those who don't know, I'm sorry, what's his name? I only know him by South Nark.
Craig Douglas is his name.
Craig Douglas.
South Nark is his Instagram.
South Nark is his Instagram. And he's this, he's a guy who has been talking about reverse edge knife tactics for a long time from the context of undercover DEA kind of stuff, being in confined spaces like cars and such. And how do you fight if you're grappling in a car and you're behind it, you know? So he's come up with a whole, you know, obviously out of experience, he's come out of this whole use of that reverse edge. And, also, like you said, he is a gentleman. He posts, shots of him all dappered up, and he talks about how you dress as a gentleman too. It's pretty cool. This is how you eviscerate someone, and then this is how you dress nicely.
Yeah, afterwards to go have a drink and a smoke. Yeah,
exactly. Okay, so remind us of the model you're holding.
So this model is the Ditch Sacket. So there's a regular sacket that's a thicker stock, thicker handle. All the Ditch series stuff is 16th inch steel, thinner stock, thinner lay.
So I have a Ditch series pick, the Ditch pick here. And so it's very thin. That's one of the things. I got this several months back, and on the show I kept showing it off, and I carry it frequently. And so when I do a pocket check on my show, I frequently have this. And something I always talk about is how how slender that blade stock is and how it slips through between atoms. It's so thin. So one thing I really love about this is the handle. I love that it's got a place to put your thumb on top to cap that. I love the shape of it. It reminds me of if you blew it up, it'd be like a cool Bowie, handle. It's a really great shaped handle, and I love it. And then I look at the Sackett, and that's also a really great shaped handle. Different philosophy. I mean, it hides completely in your hand. And like you said, it conforms exactly to your clenched fist. So it's a different style thing, but I love them both. And the thing I like about the Sackett, just seeing it in your hand, is that there's no way someone's going to be able to pry that out of your hand. Like the most skilled knifeman is not going to be able to use that punyo to pry it out of your hand.
Right.
It's buried in there.
Yeah. That was by design. Again, like I said, my wife was super worried about somebody prying this out of her hand. So, we went through different handle shapes and this was the one that we both agreed on, that we both liked quite a bit.
So how did JB Knife and Tool start?
Well, so I moved to San Antonio from Houston. And when I was living in Houston, I was working in a knife maker shop named Warren Thomas. Hmm. And so I worked out of his shop for a while. He needed a CAD guy to do drafting work to get his blades cut. And I wanted to learn how to make knives. So it worked out pretty well. And then so when I moved to San Antonio, I was making knives in my garage just for friends and family and whatnot. And I worked at an engineering company as a mechanical designer, and they gave me kind of a partner to team up with to work on some heavier projects. And that was John, and him and I hit it off right away. And he wanted to learn how to make knives. So he started coming over and we created JB Knife and Tool. And that was back in August of 2013, I think. And it was interesting at the time because he had a little shop set up in his garage. I had a little shop set up in my garage. So we would make components and then meet up at the day job because we shared an office. And then he made the handles and I made the blades, and then we would meet up and like assemble stuff. And then I would take it home and finish it. And then we'd bring it back to the office and box them up and ship them out. So it's super inefficient.
Yeah. Super inefficient, but it made work fun to go to.
It did. Yeah. It was a ball.
All right. Time. So philosophical question. Yes. You, with what you can do and with what John could do, you could build anything, essentially, any sort of product. Why knives?
We like knives. I mean, I've always liked knives. And, my grandpa gave me a little pocket knife that my dad gave him, when I was 8 years old. And then from then on, I got a knife every year from him for Christmas. Mm-hmm. And that just kind of started, the whole snowball. And John's always been into outdoorsy stuff and things, and he wanted to make knives, and it just kind of snowballed into us doing knives. But we do a lot of other stuff also. Like, we make brass knuckles and we make war clubs, and we've made some swords, and we do, so there's a bunch of little one-off stuff that JB Knife and Tool has made for people. And there's, people still in certain parts of the service that call and, hey, I need this tool made, to do a job. And I'm like, great. And we'll make a one-off little whatever for their needs. So we enjoy just building anything, but I've always had a love for different types of knives and historical knives and trying to come up with new ideas and things like that.
So you mentioned that before you kind of got into your current groove, I'm not gonna pigeonhole you, but this right now seems to be your current groove.
Yeah, yeah.
The Pikal style self-defense knives and other self-defense knives and easy EDC utility knives. You have one right out, the Companion, right?
Yeah, yep.
Before you kind of got into that, you were saying that you were making bushcraft knives and that kind of thing. What were those like?
They were a lot of fun. I mean, we camped a lot. We did a lot of, hunting and fishing, like I said before. So we were on kind of a bushcraft forum, and we tried to follow the trends on there. There's guys that like the American style puku knives, and then there's smaller camp knives. That's actually when we started making the Companion, was when we were still hanging around with the bushcraft and camping guys, because we would go to a friend's property, and he would put on this big event where it was like a a all weekend kind of bushcraft class and hunting event out there. And we made those companion knives as blades for us to clean deer at the camp that year. And they worked great. So then we made the companion XL and right after that. But we cleaned, that was the knife we cleaned deer with at camp for, you know, for years. And it still stuck around. We still have a couple, like, this is mine. It's been beat to hell and back, but this is the EDU, and we still make this from time to time. We have an EDH, which is a everyday hunter that's got a little bit wider, like drop point blade, a little bit wider blade. But we made these for years also. And this is a knife I carry every day and work on. And we still will do drop them in batches and things from time to time also.
So that's EDU, everyday utility.
Right, right.
Does that have a sharpened swedge on it?
This one does not. Okay. I did make some with a sharp, like the one I made my dad's got a sharpened swedge. I did another one like this that had, it was completely double-edged, and it had a Axis antler handle with leather spacers, and it looked like a gambler's knife to me, and that's what we called it, the gambler. We made a one-off of it and sold it, and still regret selling it because it was like my favorite one we've ever made, but somebody wanted to buy it, so we sold it, but it was a pretty one.
So now, okay, so now nowadays you make the self-defense knives, you make the companion, which I've seen you're doing a recently you've been doing a run of those, right?
Yeah.
So, and then there's that Batwing, which is so damn cool. That is such a sweet looking blade. If you can't see it, it looks like my ditch pick, which you've probably seen online, except the outside edge has a recurve sort of tanto, and the inside edge is a back swept, you know, curvy Sharpie edge.
Right, right.
Like I mentioned in my intro up front, like I really got tuned into you, keyed into your work after I had Ed Calderon on the show, and I was really, you know, starting to get fascinated with the fruit knife and the Elvia and the tip down edge in stuff. And then I key into your work, and I'm like, okay, so here's someone doing it at a high level. This isn't just a Victorinox fruit knife with a bent handle and some jute wrapping. You know, this is like the real deal. How did you get? It seems like you're very well appreciated in the Libra fighting and Pikal world, if that is a world. So how did you get kind of so firmly nestled in there and get a reputation there?
A lot of that was through Ed. Ed's been a huge help and support for us. We met him probably 8 years ago now. And through a friend of his, Voodoo Doc, I don't know if y'all know who he is or what. We did some work for Doc, and then Doc introduced us to Ed. And we kind of hit it off, and he's been a huge help for us pushing our name out there and testing our blades. And if I had an idea that I wanted to do, I would run it by Ed. I'd make one and I'd send it to him and tell him, you know, break this and tell me what needs to be fixed, what needs to be wrong. And he's been a huge help, with kind of streamlining the way our tools need to be built and really getting away from things that are, useless or things that can, like ring. I don't like rings on knives. That's just my, you know, and I found out later Ed doesn't like them either.
Yeah.
And then, in one of the classes we hosted for him, we found out why they're bad to put on certain knives. We had a guy cut his finger up pretty bad in the ring and split his hand open because the knife didn't go all the way past his palm. And Ed told him that's going to cut you if you use it. And he wanted to try it, and he did it and split his hand open. And it was just bad. But Ed was a huge part of why we're where we are in the community. And I think the other part of it is just communication. There seems to be a breakdown between a lot of knife makers and the communication between their customers. Mm-hmm. John and I both have always tried to keep an open line of communication between, you know, so when our customers call back and say, hey, this is uncomfortable because of this, that's a great idea. Send that knife back. Let me make you a new one and I'll send it out. And now that fix has been put into the rest of the knives, you know, and if they have a complaint about something, we've always been there to try to fix it for them, and word of mouth gets out and things kind of take off.
Yeah. You know, I've thought about that a bit, about the communication issue, because you hear that a lot, whether it's from people who spend a lot of money on knives, on custom knives, and what do you expect from a maker? Well, I expect good communication. Or whether you hear it from, you know, someone such as yourself. And I think sometimes it's a temperament issue. Some people are more artist than businessman.
Sure.
And so they like to be holed up making their craft, and then it comes time to actually do the business stuff. And I can relate to that so easily, because that's kind of me. I've been forced to change that a little bit, but I would love to be holed up doing my thing and not answering emails.
Yeah. Absolutely. But,
yeah.
But I mean, I completely understand that. Like, I can get lost in my shop for hours, and like anybody will tell you, we're horrible at answering the phone because I can't hear it in the shop half the time, right. You know? So the best way to get us is, you know, either message on Instagram or email. And I mean, sometimes it takes a day or two to get to it, but when we get to it, we try to help them out with their problem and, you know, and things like that. And you're never going to make everybody happy. There's always going to be somebody that's mad about something and they want to be mad about it. You know, but I mean, at the end of the day, these are the folks that are paying your bills. You know, they're the guys that are, they don't have to buy from me. There's 1,000 other knife makers out there that are making tools just as nice as ours, if not nicer, you know? So it benefits all of us if we just take the time, or I take the time to sit and chat with this guy on the phone or over email, or, you know, fix the problem he has with his knife, and not be a jerk about it. You know, and that seems to go a long way with folks when you just stop and take the time to chat with them or hear out their problem and fix it, you know?
Yeah. You know, sometimes even if it's like, I saw your email, I can't really address it right now.
Yeah.
But I hear you. And this is something I've been told by friends in the past, like, why didn't you call me? Well, I didn't have time. Well, you could have just said, I don't have time to talk.
Yeah,
I'm
sure.
Like, oh, you're right about that. Before we move away from testing and Ed Calderon, you said that you will send him, or you have in the past sent him prototypes. Here, Ed, check this out. What do you think? And he gets back to you. How does he test them? And then what kind of things have you learned from those tests?
Well, so, like, you know, he does the organic medium tests. And the only reason I sent blades to Ed is Ed and I had become friends by that point. You know, I'm not going to just call up some random guy and be like, hey, man, test this, you know. But he's been such a huge help with talking to me about designs and different things. And so when we decided to go to this 16th inch steel, you know, there were reservations because it's so thin. I'm like, I don't know if it'll hold up. I don't know what to expect from it. You know, so we made some and I tested them in the shop. You know, I'm pounding them through 2x4s and trying to stick them into metal drums and just like junk and crap I have in the shop. But Ed does these classes, these organic medium classes. And so we made him a ditch pick, a single edge, reverse edge ditch pick. And I sent it to Ed. I'm like, tell me what you think. Break it. You know, if it breaks, tell me where and how. And, you know, if you have the time, because we're not paying him to do it. And he's not under any obligation to do it or tell anybody about it, you know. But as a friend, he was like, yeah, I'll do that. So I sent him one and he stuck it in a pig a bunch of times. He's like, hey, man, this thing works. This thing works well. So, and he still has that knife. But, so we run a lot of things by him. We run a lot of things by Doc, you know, experts that know how these blades are supposed to perform. And then when we go to classes or we host classes, we'll bring out new designs we're working on. And when the class is done using the organic medium test that we're doing there, then we have free rein to test out all of our new stuff. And the class likes to see that too, because sometimes things will break. Sometimes things don't work out like they're planned. And, you know, we kind of go back to the drawing board on it, but it's always fun. It's always fun to watch. So,
oh yeah. The years of doing martial arts, having someone show up with a new knife was always like, you know, everyone crowds around, but if it's someone who's making it, that's even cooler.
Yeah.
I got to say, and bring in prototypes and not for nothing. I mean, I have full faith in this knife, but knowing that this 16th of an inch, you know, this is like a steak knife basically in terms of its thickness. Right. And knowing that it's been tested, not only by, you know, Ed in pig carcasses, but you in your shop pounding it through 2x4s and stuff like that. That's not something I'm willing to do with this, but I love knowing it's been through that, you know, that ringer.
Yeah. Yeah.
Because it is good. Thin and we're used to, you know, I'm used to having big, thick chunks of metal.
Sure.
And,
yeah.
And really, I guess that's one thing, but this is another thing, and it's not necessary to have that huge chunk to have a stout knife.
Well, and that was kind of our thought, too, is because like the original sackets were 5/32, which for the size blade, that's thick, you know, and it's a little over an eighth of an inch, and you know, it was fairly stout. And then we went to an eighth of an inch, and I'm like, oh, I like this a lot better. And then John and I were having a conversation at lunch one day, and I'm like, why do they have to be this thick at all for what they're doing? You know, we're not pounding them. You know, it's not like a camp knife. I'm not pounding it through an old piece of oak or having to try to shave off, you know, pieces of wood to make a fire. And, you know, it doesn't need to do any of that. It needs to go into meat and come back out, you know. So that's when we started messing with the thinner and thinner stocks. And you know, people talked crap about it at first. And, you know, that's never going to work. And then we started testing them and showing the testing. And now we've got all kinds of people doing 16th-inch steel stuff now. And so it's just, you know, the way this industry evolves. But it's a lot of fun for us.
Oh, yeah. Well, another really important part about it is that these are meant to be everyday carry items. They're meant to be easily carried and 16th of an inch. I mean, this knife is like featherweight. It's very, very light.
Right.
Yeah. And, you know, yeah, 16th of an inch thick steel. It's going to be light. You're going to carry it more often. I carry this knife a lot, and that's probably one of the reasons. It's very low profile, you know, and I think the weight is a big issue.
Yeah, and I think so too. And I, like I said, I enjoy carrying a lighter knife. But there are times when I want a like you said, a big thick honking piece of steel. You know, if I'm out camping or if I'm making a big long blade that needs to lop through something, you know, I want to have some weight, some mass behind it.
Yeah.
But for these EDC knives, these everyday carry knives, I don't like to go much thicker than an eighth of an inch. You know, because it doesn't need to be. You know, we're not prying with it. We're not, you know, at least the ones that I'm making here have a certain purpose, you know, like the Companion and the Companion XL. We've tried with those, you know. John and I wore those as work knives when we were working at the same engineering research company, you know, and we used them to scrape old gaskets off of flange faces. And hey, I can't quite get this nut loose off of this flange, no problem, I'll just hammer the knife between the flange and let it, you know, separate the two pieces apart. Like, we beat them up bad. But that was, you know, that's kind of our job, right? Is to beat on them a little bit and see what they'll do and when they'll break. And when customers call in and they're like, oh, I don't know what happened to my knife. I put it in my pocket one day and I took it out, and the next day it's solid rust. And I'm like, that looks like you left it in a fish tackle box. And I know that because
I've done it. So times have changed since the days where you came into lunch and showed him what you did, and he showed you what he did, and all that. So what's your working relationship like with John in terms of designing, and then in terms of building? How does all that look like?
It's getting pretty streamlined now. I mean, so I work in the shop full time now, and Brandon comes in with me and helps. My son, my oldest boy, he comes in and helps me. And then John comes in, when he can come in, either early in the morning, cause he still has a day job. So he comes in either early in the morning before his day job, or, maybe for like an hour at lunch, or, after his day job before he goes and picks the kids up, he can swing by. But he does a lot of the stuff that keeps the business running that I don't want to do, you know, or that I can't, you know. He, you know, takes care of the taxes, paperwork, make sure all the materials ordered, make sure everything's shipping out on time. There's a staggering amount of work involved in just those pieces. But he also does like the programming for all the CNC machines, like when we cut the handles and for when we cut the Kydex sheaths and stuff like that. Like, he has to sit and program all this stuff. That's things he can do at home. He doesn't have to come to the shop to do that. And then he'll come to the shop one morning, or on a Saturday, and we'll sit and, okay, here's the new program. We'll test cut the handles. Okay, these are great. And then I can run the machine, you know, while he's at the day job. So it's progressed quite a bit since we both had two little bitty shops at our house, but it's a pretty decent workflow now. One day I'll get him on full time, but he does have a really good job. So it's hard to walk away from that.
Yeah, I hear that. So your shop is a place where you go and seek refuge and make knives, and you bring your son.
Yes.
Okay, so he's the gentleman I've seen in the pictures on your Instagram.
Yeah, yeah, that's him.
So how do you like working with your son?
I enjoy it. I love it. I mean, he's a blast to have in the shop. I mean, he's got autism, and he's fairly high functioning, and so it's always an adventure. You know, a lot of times he's super quiet. You don't know he's there until he's like self-talking and doing the shows and stuff like that. But if you give the boy a task to do, say, hey, man, I need you to do this. Cool. He never complains, never gripes. He just gets up and goes to work. Now, you can't be in a hurry for what you have him doing, because it's going to take all day, you know, but it'll get done and it'll be perfect.
Yeah, I was going to say perfect, probably.
Yeah, it'll be spot on, but it's going to take a little while. But he recently had his own project that Doc gave him an idea for. His own project, and that was those wooden handled ice picks.
Oh, man, those were okay. All right.
So that was his baby. I got to teach him how to use a chop saw, how to use a wood lathe, how to use the grinder, and how to assemble all those pieces together. And he did all of it himself, and he made 124 pieces, which was a lot. And he worked his tail off on that, but didn't complain, he never gripes, so he's a lot of fun to have in the shop. He's a hard worker.
Is he going to do those again? I was just, because before, I'm sorry to interrupt you, okay. Before this interview, I was going back through your Instagram. I was like, oh, I remember those. Like, I remember when he was making those, and they're like wooden, they're about, I don't know, maybe 10 inches long, wooden, circular wooden with finger grooves on one side. You pull it apart and it's an ice pick.
Yeah.
So cool.
So he, and I love him because his innocence is amazing, right? So we made the prototype, and I was looking, and that's the prototype there. We made the prototype, and I was looking all over the place for it in the shop one day because I wanted to take another picture and send it to Doc, and I couldn't find it. And so I asked Brandon, where's the ice pick? He's like, it's in the freezer, in the ice bag. And I'm like, why is it in the freezer? He's like, because it's an ice pick. What else are you going to do with an ice pick?
Nice. I love that.
Good point, buddy. You're absolutely right. So,
a little known fact about our producer, Jim, who works behind the scenes here, he has an ice pick collection. He's got some really cool old antiques of various sorts. And one of his things to collect are ice picks. So I thought he might like that.
Yeah, absolutely. We will get one. Brandon is doing a small batch right now. And it's mainly for, some friends of ours that, weren't able to get on the original order, right? But I'm trying to talk him into doing another run. You know, hey, let's just do another run of like 50, you know, ice picks. And he's thinking about it right now. He's very much we already did that. Why would we do it again? You know?
Yeah.
Okay, bud. So I'm trying to talk him into doing another run. So we'll see. We'll see how that goes.
That's one of the things I really like. You know, I've talked to a lot of knife makers on this show, and I love family businesses in one way or another. I love hearing about family members working with family members. And, I don't know. I think it's a cool thing to be able to share because, love for knives is maybe from the outside, just a little bit offbeat, but those of us who love knives, love knives. And to be able to share that with someone, and then also to be able to, you know, someone you love, like your son, and then to be able to build them and build something with them together. I think that's part of this American dream. I keep talking about makers seem to live the American dream. Doesn't mean it's not hard. Doesn't mean you're not working your butt off the whole time.
Absolutely. Yeah. But no, he's a lot of fun to have in the shop. Ed calls him the best hype man ever. Cause if you've ever seen any of his videos, if you've ever met Brandon in person, like he's super quiet all the time. And then you turn a camera on and you get what, you know, those videos that we have on our page. None of that is scripted. That is him going, Dad, grab your phone. I want to make a video. Cool, man. So I grab it and he goes off. And my favorite one, I think, is when we were introducing the goblin knife. And he did that creepy, weird voice when he says the goblin every time. And it was funny. But he's definitely built his own little following on our page of people that are there for the Brandon videos.
Yeah,
He's a riot.
So tell me a little bit about the business. Of not like, what have you learned about being, about doing this and being full time in the knife business? What kind of lessons have you learned?
You've got nobody to blame but yourself. You know, that's one of the biggest things. you have to hold yourself accountable for things. So we're working in an industry that is huge. And if you build up any kind of following, there's no reason, I say there's no reason to not be doing well, but you know, you can sit on your butt and you can complain about all the things that are going wrong, or you can get off your butt and go out and work. And when you get off your butt and you go out and work, then all the good things that you want start happening, you know. And it's, I tell my wife all the time, what I love about running my own business is the amount of work I put in directly correlates with how much money we get to bring home, you know. And I know that's not always the case, you know, but, you know, if you want to be successful, you got to put in the work. The other thing is running your own business is really hard, because it's real easy to not hold yourself accountable. Like, you know, I could sleep in until, you know, 10 today, and it's, you know, but you're missing out on all that time you could be in the shop working and making money. So at the very beginning, that was hard for me, because all of a sudden I didn't have a boss. I didn't have anybody telling me I had to be at work at any certain time. I didn't have, you know, but then all of a sudden you still got to pay bills. You know, your rent still due, your car notes still due, your kids need food and clothes and everything else. And, for me, it's really helped push my work ethic a little bit harder. I mean, I've always been one to try to work myself to death anyway, but, that's been a big part of it. The other thing is trying to find a balance between getting in there and working and saving enough time to come home and play with the kids. And there was some fluctuation there for a little while, because it's like, well, okay, if I spend 18 hours in the shop, then I can get this much stuff done. Mm-hmm. And that means this much money to come home. But then you're too tired and you're too, don't have enough time to go spend that money with the kids and family and whatnot. So it's trying to find that balance between the two was another lesson to be learned. And I think we've hit a pretty good stride right now, and we're enjoying things quite a bit.
Yeah, it seems like that that beginning of a business or of any venture, it requires that kind of devotion in the beginning, and it's a sacrifice. And you know, the sacrifice is now for later. And
right.
And you know, if you hadn't have put in 18 hours a day initially, you might be still in the shop right now tonight.
You know? That's true. Yeah. I mean, and it's, you find a balance, and you find, you know, the, one of the hardest things for me to break was, and John and I talked about this quite a bit, because he still has a day job. So he still works, you know, essentially 8 to 5, right? And you get that 40 hour a week mindset, you know? But when you put in the work up front, like anytime you're starting a new business, you're putting in a ton of time, a ton of hours at the beginning. And now we're at a point where we kind of have a rhythm to things, and we have a, you know, a process. So I don't have to do that 40 hours, you know, or 8 to 5 mindset this week. I just have to make sure that I get X amount of blades out the door. Mm-hmm. So it's a different mindset. Instead of thinking, you know, of I have to have 40 hours in this week, I say, okay, I have to have 50 knives done this week. You know, now that might take me 7 days, you know, that week, depending on what I'm doing, or it might take me 3.5 or 4. And then I've got a couple of days where I can go spend time with the wife and kids, you know, because I got that 50 knives done. That covers all our bills, extra money, salaries, you know, et cetera, et cetera. And so when you start looking at things in terms of, okay, how many knives does it take this week to get what we need done? It takes a lot of stress off, you know, because now I don't feel like I'm in the shop today, but all the knives are ground, all the handles are done. What am I supposed to do today? You know, and it kind of takes that part out of it when I can just focus on, okay, we have to make sure that we have this batch done, you know, this many knives done, and not have to worry about how much time you're actually putting in the shop.
You mentioned rhythm, and that's a good word. I mean, because once you kind of get in a rhythm or in a groove, you know, things are going well. How does that rhythm work with, the production of knives in terms of like runs of knives? I know when I bought this ditch pick, several months back, you announced that you were working on a batch of them. How does that work? How you release models and stuff?
Okay. So this has been a process for John and I to figure out for a while. So, you know, we had the whole, you know, custom. We did the whole custom thing for a while where you could get on the webpage and pick what blade you want, what steel you want, what handle color, shape, grind, blade grind, you know. And what it did was it just bogged us down time-wise, you know, where it should only take us a week to knock out a certain amount of blades. It's taken us 3 weeks because now I've got to cut an individual set of, you know, neon green handles because it's got, you know what I mean? So
it was
just all these different layers to it. And we were just getting super burned out on it. So we went to doing batches. So where I say, okay, this week I want to do, you know, ditch picks. I want to just work on ditch picks. So we'll get, you know, we do the CAD file up, send it to the water jet guy and have him cut out however many ditch picks will fit on a sheet of steel that we can get. It might be 50, might be 100. Okay. And then I can say, okay, over the next week, I need to do 50 of these ditch picks for a drop. Okay. So now I need to cut out 50 handles and get 50 sets of sheets done. And that's minimum. That's to meet orders. And now I can get extras done if I have time. So that way in 2 more weeks, when I want to do another ditch pick drop or ditch sacket drop or whatever we were working on, I've got these extras set aside. So now I've already got these 15 that have already been made that weren't part of the original 50, you know, that we did over here. So now I only need to make 20 of this knife or 30 of this knife or whatever to do that. And it just helps us focus on, you know, one or two things. Like we might be working on 2 batches at a time, but it's still just two designs, you know, and I know I'm going to do half of this batch reverse and half of this batch reverse and half belly. And this one's going to be double edged and this one's going to be reversed. And I know I have a certain amount to make so I can get in and just get into a rhythm. I've got 100 knives to grind over the next 2 weeks. I've got this many reverse, this many double edged, and you can just get in there at the grinder and go to town. Not have to worry about anything.
You know what? This reminds me kind of something I learned at work, at a different job, but it carries through every job I've been to, which is, you know, I'm in a creative field. And when you give someone, endless options, they have, you know, oh, well, you know, they feel an obligation to exercise,
right,
those options and to to make things as difficult on you as possible.
Yeah.
Not on purpose, of course, but, right, you know, right, of course, if someone comes up to you and says, here, you can have this any way you want it, you're going to be like, well, you know, so, but your product is specific and desirable. You know what I'm saying? Like, you're not just a general purpose. I mean, you do make general purpose knives, but you're more of a niche, business. You know, you're making a niche product in a lot of ways. Right. And that itself is the special part. Like who needs, ebony handles on this knife? I mean, it would be cool, of course, but I mean, that's not part of what it's really about. It's not a, it's not an art knife. It's a for use knife, right, you know?
I mean, and that's, so our goal right now is to get the production side of things the way we're doing now, set up to where, I mean, the knives are all still hand ground, right? So I'm still grinding all the blades by hand. We use a CNC machine to cut the handles. I use a CNC machine to cut the sheets now, which is a new thing for us. We got a vacuum mold, all this kind of stuff that we can.
That's your new pancake sheets?
Yeah.
And yeah, yeah.
I mean, mainly we started doing it because I wanted repeatability. You know, before I was making all the sheets by hand, you know, cutting them out on the bandsaw. And when you're trying to knock out 50 knives for the week, you know, or 100 blades for, it gets time consuming. So we were trying to streamline everything. And I'm also trying to create jobs in the shop that I can sit Brandon down and have him do. You know, buddy, this is your job. You know, you got to cut this Kydex, put it on this mold and hit that button, you know, and if it's something repeatable, he can come in and knock that out. So that's a task he can do. It's something I can pay him for as, you know, as an employee. But we're trying to get it set up to where Brandon or maybe a couple of people come in and they can knock out this bread and butter stuff. I'm still grinding all the blades, but then that'll leave me time to work on small batches of just full custom. I'm hand shaping the handles. I'm back to forging blades out, you know, all of this kind of stuff and doing like limited runs of like small one-offs or whatever that I really want to make, you know.
Yeah.
I get an idea in my head where, you know what, this EDU would look really nice with some, you know, mammoth ivory and, you know, a Damascus blade. And then I've got time to sit down and put time into that instead of feeling like I have to rush it.
Yeah. Yeah, that makes perfect sense. You know, you get something, through humans, somewhat automated, you know, and kind of rolling on its own. And then you can, of course, this whole period of time you've been making these, I'm sure all these ideas for these have come up that you've not been able to, check out or explore because you've got knives to make, you know, you've got these to pump out. But I'm sure you have thought about this in Damascus with a, by the way, this would look so cool in Damascus with a, mammoth ivory. Yeah. And man, I'm a sucker for mammoth ivory. How cool would that look?
It's been on my mind for a long time. And we actually have a guy in the shop, Chris Aguayo he owns Bare Metal Creations, and he's a blacksmith knife maker, and he shares space in our shop with us, but he makes his own Damascus in the shop, and it's gorgeous. And we definitely have different types of knife designs. Like, we're definitely on different ends of the spectrum design wise, but the Damascus he makes is beautiful. And so there's been times where he's made me a little Damascus billet for, you know, a small private knife. So I want to do that for a ditch pick or a mini pick, you know, something I can show off his work on as well. So it's coming. I just need time to work on it.
So you mentioned before forging out knives. Is that how you started? Were you actually forging?
So I started in stock removal working for Warren Thomas. And then when I moved to San Antonio, I had a friend of mine that was a knife maker that was a blacksmith and a bladesmith. And so I started going and hanging out with him at his house. And then when he quit and went into bow making, I bought his anvil and his forge from him. And so I started forging blades for the bushcraft, you know, community and whatnot. And we still were doing stock removal also, but I was doing a lot more forge blades there as well. And I still do some from time to time that are just private knives. I make them for family. I make them for friends. And I don't sell them. And I don't sell them right now on purpose because I don't want people asking me to make more. I know that sounds stupid, but I don't want to tell people no until I have or I don't want to show it until I have the time to actually sit and do it for real for folks. So that's the plan with the whole kind of mid-tech thing that we're doing or trying to get towards so that I have more time to work on forging and custom stuff.
Okay. You said the word mid-tech. I want to check that out for just a quick second, but
before
we do, what do you get all right, it's going to sound corny, but what do you get spiritually out of forging and what do you get spiritually out of stock removal? And I think you can tell from this question, I feel like forging is one of those processes that's a little bit transcendent.
It's just another creative outlet to kind of get you to the same end goal, right? I can make the same knife, and I've done this with we have a bigger blade called a Sansibar that we've sold a few of. The very first one of that knife was forged, and I have it in the trunk of my car. You know, it's a big forged 24-inch blade, you know, curvy, like recurve short sword, essentially, is what it was. They're both the same design, but they're both completely different. And as far as, like, the spiritual aspect of it, to me, I love designing and I love making things. So stock removal is just one way for me to make whatever it is I've designed. And there's something therapeutic for me at sitting at the grinder. I don't know why. It's my favorite part. I mean, it's the part that kills my body the most, you know, but I love standing at the grinder, putting my headphones on, you know, listening to some music or an audiobook or something, or just putting earmuffs on so I don't hear anything else and just being alone with my thoughts while I sit there and grind blades, you know. That's my absolute favorite part to this. As far as the stock removal goes, I mean, the forging goes, it's the same thing. It's kind of a therapeutic, it's got a therapeutic asset to it because you're watching the blade change color when it goes from forging temperature to cool. You know, you're trying to get your strikes in before it gets to a certain temperature. You're trying to manipulate the steel like Play-Doh to try to get it to become the shape that you want. You know, it's a whole different aspect of getting that design to come to life. You know, so there's definitely two different feelings to it, but I don't feel like one is more or less better or worse as far as like total outcome to it. And we've had that conversation with a lot of our friends that are stock removal guys versus forging guys. And, and things like that. But foraging to me a lot of times is, it's a lot of work to get to that blank that I get back from the water jet guy.
Right. You know? Right. So I asked that corny question because to me, foraging is still a bit of a mystery. I mean, I've watched every Forged in Fire, and I even sat in on a few foraging classes, but it's still, you know, I've never done it myself, and it still feels like mystery. You know, you're applying heat to this element and then you're pounding it out, and who knows? I don't know. It's kind of the right color. You know, to me, it seems a lot more, you know, whereas I understand the concept of taking a plate and removing everything that's not a knife.
Yeah, absolutely. And there's a science to it. There's definitely a science to knowing, like, what does 1500 degrees look like, you know, color wise on that steel? How close can you get it, you know, by eyeball? And that has a lot to do with how much ambient light do you have in your shop? You know, how dark is it? How, what type of forge are you, you know, do you have cold spots in your forge? Are you getting an even heat all the way through? You know, there's a definite science to forging, and it is, much more. There is more skill and more work involved in forging a blade than there is stock removal of a blade. But there is still a lot of work and a lot of science that goes into the stock removal side of things as well. Whether you're cutting it out with a bandsaw or whether you're trying to program a CNC machine to do what you need to do, there's still a lot of, you know, thought involved in it and a lot of just a lot of work one way or the other. It's just the work is just different.
Yeah. So you mentioned the term mid-tech before, and I know what you were referring to, what you had just been talking about, not automation, but a way to get your process even more streamlined with the help of other people so that you can focus on more personal projects while these other knives are going. But have you considered or thought about or been approached or anything about collaborations with production companies? It seems like your designs would be just so ready for that.
We've talked to a few, and I mean, we might consider it down the line as well. I like having control of my own stuff. You know, it's, I can't help it. It's hard to let go of that control, but I like to know that I made what we put out there, if that makes any sense. But, you know, for us, it's, we started cutting the handles because it was a way to speed up the process of making the knives, right? So we started CNC cutting all the handles so that we would get repeatability. And then we started, you know, we bought the vacuum mold and started CNC cutting the sheaths for the same thing. And because we have these handles that are repeatable, that makes the sheath process repeatable. And all of that just kind of speeds up, you know, but the heat treat's still done by us. The grinding's still done by us. If I have enough time in between batches, I will absolutely send blades over to someone like Peters Heat Treat or some professional heat treat company to heat treat those blades, because that's 2 weeks worth of work that I can be doing something else, you know, because if I get, 200 knives in and I have to sit and heat treat 200 knives, and that takes a long time. So if I can send it to someone like that I get a certificate back saying it's this hardness, I will absolutely use that shortcut. Heck, if I can figure out a grinding jig that uses a cam where I can stick Brandon on the grinder and knock those things out, I'll do that too. but there's still like our one-off stuff, and there's still something therapeutic about sitting at the grinder and grinding blades and all that. But, as far as mid-tech goes, I think if you're still grinding blades by hand, and you're still doing the heat treat and you're doing, you know, the fit and finish of the handles and the sheath, all that has to be done by hand also. You know, I get a rough handle off the CNC machine. I could probably put more time in and contour it and clean it and all that kind of stuff. But I like having the final say-so on that handle when it's done. You know, I like putting the final buff on that, you know, the edge of that sheath when it's, you know, when it's comes off the machine and I assemble it together. You know, there's something to that I like. But we have talked about going towards, I've got an old Bridgeport CNC machine in the back of the shop that we have been rebuilding. And if I can get that thing to put bevels on a blade and then I come back and sharpen it, then we'll have a mid-tech line. You know, it won't be like a, you know, a custom knife or anything. It'll be a mid-tech knife. and then I can do mid-techs and then focus on custom handmade one-off stuff.
Well, that would be cool. I'd love to see what your custom one-off stuff looks like. What are you guys working on? What do you have that you can reveal here that you're working on for future designs in knives?
Well, we've been doing so the future stuff that we haven't released yet. We're working on a trench knife. We've had people ask us for a trench knife for a while now, and our good buddy Doc called and said, "Hey guys, I need you to make a trench knife." So now we're making a trench knife, and we've got a few designs coming up that are designed by Voodoo Doc that I think are going to be amazing. Some of them, a few of them, people got to see at Ed and Doc's Cleveland class when we had an organic meeting there. We took the fast blades and the street sweeper sacks out there, and so I'll have some pictures of those up soon. I think there's a couple of people that have pictures of the fast blades out right now. I haven't posted them yet, but some of the guys that were at the class have posted pictures of Doc's fast blade. So we've got that, the trench knife.
So I'm assuming the trench knife has knuckle dusters, right?
Yes. Yeah.
Oh, what's the fast knife?
The fast knife is a blade that was designed by Doc to be used in some of the combatives classes that he's going to be teaching. And it's got a hooked handle on it. The hook comes back this way. Edge is still facing that way. And it's so that the web of your hand can catch that hook as you draw it out of your... and it's a thinner stock blade. We also have a tomahawk coming out that was designed by Doc as well to be used for combative work, you know, in his field of what he does. And so we also tested that at the Cleveland class. So there's guys out there that can attest to how well that did on a pig as well. But it's a compact tomahawk, and it's super fast. So we're really looking forward to finishing that guy up. Also,
God, I can't wait. I love tomahawks too. So I'm going to have to look up, this fast knife, find out what that's all about. So tell us, tell listeners how they can get in touch with you and with JB Knife and Tool, and the best way to go about getting their hands on one of your knives.
So to get in touch with us, if you have any questions or anything that you would like to talk about, the best way to get a hold of us is on Instagram. Just send us an Instagram message. We try to get to all of them. It might take us a couple of days, but we try to get to all the messages and answer them. Second best way would be through email on our website. Phone calls, as much as I would absolutely love to talk to everybody, because I do like to talk to folks, I never hear the phone in the shop. I am so sorry, but it's loud in there, man.
Yeah. If you hear the phone, you're not doing it right.
Exactly. Yeah. No, we got a power hammer running, got grinders going. It's loud in there. That's probably the best way to get a hold of us. And look out on our Instagram page for when we drop our batches. If there's a certain knife or a product that you're looking forward to, if you go to our website, there's a waiting list under each product. So if there's something you like, join the waiting list for it. When we're doing a batch of those, we will send you an email about a day or two before we drop them on Instagram. So the waiting list folks get first dibs, and then everything that's left over gets put on as an Instagram drop.
All right. Well, there you heard it. Brian, thank you so much for coming on the Knife Junkie Podcast. It's been a pleasure.
Thank you for having me. It was a good time.
Yeah. And thanks for this really, really awesome knife.
Very glad you liked it.
You know, I'm very glad that someone's making it. I'm glad you guys are making it. Thank you.
Appreciate it.
All right.
Visit the Knife Junkie at theknifejunkie.com to catch all of our podcast episodes, videos, photos, and more.
There he goes, Brian Moreland of JB Knife and Tool. Go check them out on Instagram, JB Knife. Just making some really, really cool EDC fixed blades, most of which tend towards the self-defense, but they also have some pretty straight ahead practical offerings as well. It's just a matter of timing to get in. A lot of people want their knives, so keep an eye out for them. Also, keep an eye out for the next podcast with another great Knife World luminary. And of course, there's Wednesday, the supplementary show, where I show off knives that are coming across my desk and talk about certain features, you know, at length. And then, of course, Thursday night Knives is our live stream where you can come join the conversation right here on screen with us. So be sure to check us out. For Jim, working his magic behind the switcher, I'm Bob DeMarco saying, until next time, don't take dull for an answer.
Thanks for listening to the Knife Junkie Podcast. If you enjoyed the show, please rate and review at reviewthepodcast.com. For show notes for today's episode, additional resources, and to listen to past episodes, visit our website, theknifejunkie.com. You can also watch our latest videos on YouTube at theknifejunkie.com/YouTube. Check out some great knife photos on theknifejunkie.com/Instagram and join our Facebook group at theknifejunkie.com/Facebook. And if you have a question or comment, email them to bob@theknifejunkie.com or call our 24/7 listener line at 724-466-4487 and you may hear your comment or question answered on an upcoming episode of the Knife Junkie Podcast.